Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg, and Adam Barrett is on the line also. Hey, Adam.
Hey, Fred. How's it going?
Hey, pretty good. I wanted to jump right into this one, which is the third part of a three-part mini-series we're doing about reliability program assessment. And this one is on, now that we've collected a bunch of interview information, a bunch of notes of insights into what this organization's actually doing by talking to a handful of different people. Now we've got like 8 to 12 sheets of paper full of scribbled notes. And if we were lucky and had two people doing the interviews, the notes are more likely legible, more likely complete.
Yep.
But now we got to make sense of this. Because the focus during the data collection phase, the conducting the assessment, is really just collect data and trying not to, which is difficult, to conduct the analysis simultaneously, because then you start filtering what you're hearing. So it's something to guard against, is knowing that you're going to analyze it and look at it later, is don't do that during the interviews. But now we're at that stage where we've got all this information, and this company, this organization's looking at you going, so what do you think? You know, what do we need to do next?
Do you know what's great about that analysis thing is it directly carries over from if you're a good reliability engineer solving any problem, because that's one of the things when you do like even a 5-why analysis is to as clearly as possible state the problem. You know, just the facts, ma'am.
And yeah, good quote. We'll have to... I have to put a credit in there for that quote.
That was old Dragnet, I think, right?
Yeah, that's right. Just the facts, man. Just the facts.
Just the facts, man.
But it's true. As soon as you start jumping to a conclusion about what you think they need to do, you'll hear things that will support it, and you'll ignore things that don't. And so it really is a different process of analyzing the data and making sense of it. Different than trying to make sure you hear it correctly and that it's and you're hearing things consistently. It's different than, oh, you need to do FMEA. That's the hole in your program. You need to go do that. And then the rest of your conversations turn into a classroom, basically, which isn't the purpose of the collecting data. So at this point, you got tons of notes. You've heard a bunch of information. If you recorded it, if the person you're talking to is comfortable with a recorder, you can get it transcribed if you want to go through that or listen to them again, listen to pieces of them. When I do it, it's just taking notes fast and furiously and summarizing things I actually hear. And the objective of the analysis is to come out with a snapshot or a picture, to use an analogy, of their reliability program. This is what you do. And then the secondary or the second objective is then, here's what I would recommend you do different. You know, building on your strengths or shoring up weaknesses. Here's what you're doing that's going well, that's good stuff, and here's things you can do to enhance that and so on.
Where, Fred, in there does the goal part come, where they want to be? Because I feel like whenever I've, you know, been a part of this process, I always take caution in not just assuming that they want to get to the maximum level, because that, that may not be where their sales will maximize, right? There are, you do have target reliabilities that aren't always the maximum, because there's things that are more important, like the latest feature that's unstable or the lowest cost.
Well, that's one of the questions I ask. I mean, early on in the, we should have probably put that in the preparation part, is, well, what's the objective of this? Are you trying to improve reliability, or are you really trying to improve the reliability program so that it's more efficient? You can, instead of doing every test in the book, you only do the ones you need to do, for example. Mm-hmm. It may be looking for opportunities where, independent of whatever the target is, the target reliability for the products is, how do we achieve that more effectively or more efficiently, more accurately? Mm-hmm. So it's improving a reliability program may help to improve the product reliability or the service reliability, but it doesn't necessarily have to. It just may the goal may be to be just be more efficient.
Yeah.
So part of that is upfront, what's the objective of the assessment? What are you trying to achieve? And I almost always make the assumption it's to be what you do related to reliability adds more value, which oftentimes leads to improving product performance, is reliability performance, but not always. It may be saving a cost. Instead of spending so much doing so many different reliability activities, how do we decide which ones to do that are most effective? Mm-hmm. It might be the objective. Or time to market may be a biggest concern. How do we reduce the risk of finding something late in the program that delays the program? How do we reduce that risk? So the value may come from a variety of different ways. Mm-hmm. But the snapshot picture of what we're doing is really the first step is summarizing and what's the right word? Grok, I think, is the gestalt is a German word, is what I'm looking for. But I think grok is the California word that's the closest I can get to. That means, you know, get your arms around it and get your head around what it is that they do and don't do, and then write that down, write it succinctly so that somebody else reading it can get a pretty good picture of what they do. Mm-hmm. Right. And so what I do is, I mean, physically, I just lay out all the sheets of paper in front of me and I look at each of the sequence of questions that I typically ask. I look at that one question across all of them, and I might have, say, 8 people I interviewed. So I'll have 8 notes or comments from those people. And then my task is to summarize that, right? And usually one of 3 things comes out of that. One is they all said exactly the same thing, you know, give or take a few words or phrasing, but they may be all in sync, and that's easy. I just pick a nice summary that captures what they all told me. And that's done. They do halt testing, and they do it to find weaknesses in products that they're unsure about. Perfect, mm-hmm. Right? It's a good application of halt. They all said they do it the same way. They all understand it. Another scenario is, and this one's more common, is some of the people that are familiar with the halt process, for example, maybe a mechanical engineer or design engineer, and maybe the reliability engineer, but the procurement people and maybe the electrical engineers are not involved with that process at all, or haven't been when it's been done. So they're more vague. They will say stuff like, I believe it's done over there. I don't get involved with it too much. Mm-hmm. Right. And so 2 or 3 people that are in the know answer that question. The other ones pass, essentially. A variant of that is some people are generically, is probably the wrong word, but tend to be more optimistic. And they say, oh, we do halt and we do it very well and we do it all the time. And they explain it borderline on what they think I want to hear. Whereas other people tend to be more pessimistic and say, yeah, we've done halt and I'm not real sure it's useful. But they're both describing the exact same phenomena, that on like 2 of the last 5 programs, they ran a halt sequence, mm-hmm. and they describe similar events and similar outcomes. It's just that they filter their answer based on how they view the world. And so remember the scoring I said to pretty much ignore earlier?
Right.
You'll see that pattern is the pessimist will have 1s and 2s, lower scores in general, and they'll match the pattern of the 4s and 5s that the optimist gives.
Yeah. Right.
And so if something that they truly do, both will give it a higher score and tend to be. So anyway, that's one sequence I see is, and then you weight in your summary or average is the ones that were in the know, that they have the hands-on experience with, say, accelerated testing or HALT testing or whatever the question was about. Mm. And then a third scenario is they're all over the map. One guy says, I know what HALT is, but we never do it here. It's a waste of time. You know, we never do it. And another one says, oh, we do it on every program, every project. And there's not a lot of consistency there. Now, that's pretty rare that you get.
Well, actually, I was going to ask, what is one of the biggest disconnects you've experienced? I've had some that have definitely surprised me. But what's one of the largest disconnects you've seen? Or, you know, even if it's just on a specific variable that you've wanted to measure, or on a general perception?
And I think I mentioned it in one of the earlier episodes, is the team that was actually conducting the HALT testing and writing beautiful reports thought it was being done effectively on every prototype that needed it done. Whereas the design engineering manager was like, yeah, we have to do it because we're told to do it, but we ignore the results because it's overstressed. So of course it's going to fail. Mm-hmm. And so the disconnect was one part of the team thought they were being done very effectively, and the other part of the team pretty much ignored them because they didn't understand it. Mm-hmm. And so there was the disconnect there was, you know, then it led to an obvious recommendation. Hey, why don't you guys talk about what this test is about and get to a common understanding?
Right.
You know, and if you don't understand it and you're not going to use it, don't run the test.
Yeah.
It's a waste of time and waste of prototypes. And if you're not going to use the results, don't do it. And vice versa, if you understand it, only do it when you need it. Mm. Don't waste the lab's time, in other words.
Right.
And, but others I've been, I think one of the most interesting ones was I asked a question about, well, to what extent do you set a reliability goal for the product, for the subsystem? You know, do you do apportionment as a subset question of that? And it was one engineering team, and they all sat right next to each other. So the electrical engineer that did mostly the ASIC type stuff, he said, oh, it's, and they, unfortunately, they used MTBF. It's 5,000 hours MTBF. That's really hard to do. So I always gold plate everything. That's a hard standard. We can't, it's in the contract. We can't go less than the goal. The second engineer did the rest of the circuit board, all of the power management and all the filtering and the rest of the, all the bits and bobs around the ASIC. And he said, oh, it's 5,000 hours MTBF, you know, check, you know, they're consistent. They know what the goal is. That's great. That's really easy to achieve. I use the cheapest parts I can find. I don't pay any attention to derating anything else like that. It's a piece of cake. Don't worry about it.
Right.
You know?
Holy cow.
Yeah. You know? And the third person's the manager, and I asked her about it and goes, oh, 5,000 hours MTBF. You know, they all knew exactly what the goal was.
Right.
And she said, we don't measure it, so it's kind of immaterial. I just ignore it.
Yeah, right. Which yeah, it just feeds right into your, how do we get rid of this metric that nobody understands?
Well, it wouldn't have mattered if they had a really good reliability metric. They weren't measuring it.
So the
question was, do you set a goal? And if I would have stopped there, I would have got, they have a goal and they all know it. Great. Mm-hmm. Right. But by asking that follow-on question of, well, what do you do with it? How's that impact what you do? Those kinds of questions. I got three completely different pictures. Mm. And so I'm looking over these notes and it was inconsistent across the organization. And it was left to the individual as to how they treated their behavior concerning the goal or the objective of what they're trying to do. Mm. So that's probably the answer to your question, was the most disconnected one. And others are easier to explain, where it's just people that are in part of an organization that aren't directly involved with that particular activity.
Yeah. The one I had that shocked me more than any other was the company, it was a very large company, and the VP of R&D had been doing a very big reliability initiative for a long time, consolidating all the reliability efforts to create a new reliability department that had been going for a few years, building labs, tests, trying to link field failures directly to it. And in the, you know, in the assessment, talking with one of the senior executives above the VP of R&D, in talking with him, he was like, no, our reliability is exactly where we want it to be. We don't need it to be any better than it is. And so I asked him, I'm like, do you understand where your failure rate? And he knew, he had all the charts right in front of him. He knew exactly what the failure rates were in the field. And he was effectively directly, you know, pushing against this other initiative. And I don't even think that people lower realize it, including that VP, why, you know, a lot of these hurdles they had for getting funding or changes implemented, or why did, you know, why did opportunities to make it reliability better get overwrote, you know, get overridden by other things. And it was these other higher executives doing it. And it was astounding to see that disconnect between people pushing so hard to make this happen and the people above them, you know, certain ones feeling like from their perspective, they didn't need it to change. And I really came away with really confusion. Was it that the highest level executives just wanted it to be there as window dressing that they did reliability stuff? Or was there really that much of a disconnect with, you know, kind of probably what came down to political battles between people? You know, like you said, there's like you gave an example of somebody trying to build an empire. And, was this house of cards where people were intentionally willing to risk, you know, the success of the company just for their own gains? It was just, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe at that high a level that there was that kind of opposing, you know, initiatives.
You know, and sometimes even just the summary, the just providing back the feedback in the summary of the interviews, which doesn't include a lot of analysis other than just recording what they do, often led to just absolutely beautiful conversations about, oh, I didn't know you needed that. Oh, I didn't know you did that. Oh, you know, we need to work together to make that effective. Or a lot of times just holding a mirror up to the organization in an area that oftentimes doesn't get that kind of view. And if there's political battles or if there's funding priorities that are changing, that elephant in the room just does never gets recognized until somebody drops it in the table. So that's the process. I go through the notes and summaries and I make a summary, send that back to the participants and say, hey, did I miss anything? Did I get anything wrong? Do you have anything to add? Give them a few days. Now, during that process, my head's just spinning from all those conversations and all this notes and summarizing and going, ah, that's a disconnect. Ah, that's a strength. Ah, that's, these are parts of where they are that they're doing well. Now, simultaneously, I'm mapping them to the reliability maturity matrix, right? So are they predominantly reactive? Is the only time they pay attention to reliability is if they're, you know, a pending lawsuit for or a recall notice or something's going on, or if there's a major customer's complaining, or do they only respond to doing, quote, I'm doing little air quotes here, which are hard to show on a podcast. You know, when they have something goes wrong, then they do reliability. It's a very reactive stance, as opposed to using tools and techniques and modeling stuff to anticipate what's going to fail and dealing with that information proactively to minimize the amount of surprises that their customers provide them. And it's also looking at, well, given their circumstance, are they a heavy time to market driven organization? Are they a heavy functional, you know, features rich driven type organization or products? Or do they have cost is their driver? They have to be very mindful of cost and very thin margins, those kinds of things. And it's mapping into something like that that's germane to that organization is to then what the recommendations are. And I typically do it in a sandwich kind of way. And I learned this in a course on soccer coaching, is how to give feedback to a soccer player I'm coaching. Is say, you know, I know why you wanted to make that pass right there. That was well done. That was the right idea. You needed to do that. You need to work on your left foot's ability to make that pass accurately with a little more snap to it. Let's work on that you know, a little bit more. And, you know, but you're giving it 100%. It's great stuff. So you give them a little bit of praise. You tell them what they need to do different, and you give them some more praise.
Yep.
It's called the Orioles method of coaching.
Yeah. It's a feedback Trojan horse.
That's right.
And it's in there and you didn't realize it. You got to.
Well, yeah. What I found in providing an organization information about themselves that they may not have really recognized is that you need to tell them what they're doing well. If you just list off the 10 things that they're really screwed up on and they need to fix by this time next week, you kind of demoralize half the organization. The other half is filling out their resume, right. You know, and so that's not really helpful. Oftentimes though, and this goes into change management type stuff, it's much, much easier to polish the things that are doing really well and can build on what you already know works and then expand that. It's the concept of a beachhead, right? You establish something that's working, whether it's one department or one section or one development cycle was very successful at using, say, FMEA. And so recognize that and build on it. Set them up as heroes so that they become internal champions, encourage others to learn more about the process. And here's the internal to your own data. You can see the effects of it. Those kinds of things often are much more effective than just saying, just because you don't know anything about FMEA, you're getting bit by not anticipating what's going to fail. And FMEA is a great tool. Go do that. It might be exactly what they need to do, but it's a much harder recommendation for them to implement. Mm-hmm. So interspersing the recommendations with the information about what they do well and how they can expand that, combined with, and you actually do need to record what fails and do root cause analysis. Mm-hmm. Right. And it'll help you be more effective in making decisions, making changes, making these things stick, you know, not having to come back to it over and over again, things like that. And then, by the way, you know, your focus and your high level support is already there. That's much appreciated. This will make it work and you're funded or whatever.
Right.
But try to write the recommendations that don't just drum the drum of doom. Kind of thing. It doesn't go over well. I tend to focus on like five, give or take, depending on the particular organization recommendations. If you go much deeper than that, they either cherry pick the ones they think they can do or they don't do any of them because it's overwhelming. Mm-hmm. Most organizations can handle three to five things. And especially if they're interlinking and create virtuous cycles, mm-hmm. There's much more likelihood that the recommendations will stick and take hold and become part of what they do, which goes back to, I think, our first opening conversation about culture change.
Yep.
Is what we're after is something that's very hard to do in an organization is change their behavior. Is how they think about reliability and how they prioritize it. One of the questions I commonly ask is rank order for any given decision you're making during the design or development process or manufacturing process, rank order the priorities that dominate how you make this decision. Is it cost? Is it the functionality, the performance of the system? Is it the time to market or is it reliability? Mm-hmm. Right. And rank order those. And most organizations, like consumer organizations, the high volume consumer for the holiday market, I had one woman tell me it's time to market, time to market, time to market. Now, who cares about the other ones? You know?
Right. That's.
So if the reliability recommendations didn't fit into that set of priorities and help mitigate the risk for delays to the program or help them ensure they made their launch date on time, it was a non-starter. So part of the recommendation is to say, well, do FMEA, right? Here's a few steps on how you actually do that. Here's a book. Here's a course. Here's some outline of the steps that it takes to do it. Start it on a smaller scope project and see how it goes. Start building capability within the organization and expand that program as you go. Mm-hmm. And then it's depending on what's important to the organization is here's the value. So if you do FMEA, the likelihood of you identifying and prioritizing issues that you need to solve in your design earlier versus later gives your team more time to solve those problems. Hence, not finding it late in the program, which is so often delayed your program at a cost of X dollars per day. So if we can reduce the risk of a program delay, say that you experience 25% less delays in your program, here's the net worth of implementing an FMEA program.
Yeah.
Right. And they go, okay, we need to do FMEA, you
right.
know,
right.
kind
right.
of thing. And you give them enough content in the recommendation that they actually go do it. I'm getting ahead a little bit. The analysis part goes back to that reliability maturity matrix. And so there's different rows on the matrix that talk about management practices. And so there I'm looking for, I think your example earlier, Adam, of the consistency. What are the senior execs' priorities? And is it consistent? Or are we witnessing battles of the Titans kinds of things? And where does reliability play into those discussions? Where does it fit? And then there's roles on, say, root cause analysis, dealing with failures. Is it strictly, oh, things fail, we don't worry about that? Or is it, we understand that failure, it's a minor risk to our business, and we've chosen not to deal with it versus, oh, that's a surprise, we got to jump on that.
Right.
It's somewhere along that spectrum. So each row has a spectrum. And as you go through the notes and you're understanding what their organization does is you assign them to where they are in the maturity matrix. And then typically they'll typically line up on one column, one stage of maturity, give or take a little bit. There's a little bit of noise usually in that. But then the recommendation should take them to the next stage. It's very difficult to jump straight to the top of the maturity matrix. It does take organizational learning and experience to get there. So the analysis is looking for where are they on the matrix, and then what activities specific to that organization would help them move to the next stage.
Yep.
Right. And so that's the gist of the analysis piece of that. So we should probably put a link to the maturity matrix and the checklist and a couple other bits and pieces like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And then our upcoming course on how to do assessments.
Yeah. And I'm kind of looking forward to that. I think we could probably do a, some role-playing type stuff and do some case study kind of things on that.
Yeah. Yeah. It'll be really good.
Yeah. Because I think the first couple of assessments I did, I was obviously still learning what I was doing. And in hindsight, I wish I could have gone back and gone through the interviews again. I probably would have picked up way more. So I think what we can shoot for in the course is an idea of giving people practice of doing that, gaining that experience of what to ask and what to look for in order to get some of that experience right away. That might actually be a useful thing.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Because that really is it, right? You could read a book on it, but that's very different. The idea, of having come away from this, a course, but having already shed some of that first, first learnings and mistakes and is very valuable.
Yeah. Jeez. Well, that sounds like an advertisement for something we yet have to build. So we
call now.
Yeah. But I, if you're listening and this sounds interesting to you or something you would like to do or experience that course, let us know. I mean, give us a little nudge so that we actually get it on the calendar and make it happen, which I think, Adam, we're pretty motivated to do it. But I would also like to hear what would you like in the course? What particular areas of concern do you have or areas you're not sure about? Where can we help you with our experience to share that experience with you so that you get that and you can move very confidently into doing an assessment. So let us know. Go over to reliability.fm, and under the Speaking of Reliability show, you can find comments and comment boxes or feedback forms, or just send us a message. We're pretty easy to get a hold of, and let us know what you're looking for. And that would be cool. We should take a note on that, other than we just recorded it, what we're thinking about doing with this course.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I know. Actually, I have a book. I have a notebook here. I should flip it open and start writing.
Yeah. Well, this is a chance for our listeners to contribute to the development of the course. So we just went through the three podcast episodes, some short episodes describing a reliability program assessment and a handful of tips and things that I think would be useful for you, what it is to do it. There's obviously a lot more, and that's why we're thinking about putting a course together. So let us know. And if you're interested, and I mean, the best one would be just send money. But short of that, let us know what you're looking for and what would be helpful for you. And we'll try to make sure we build that into the course. Right. I actually had a client do that once. They sent us a check for $5,000. And we called them back up and said, why'd you do that? We didn't, you don't owe us anything. He says, well, our quarter's ending and we know we're going to spend it next month, you know, with you, but it was use it or lose it on our end. So we sent it to you. we'll get back to you later with what we want to do.
Oh, there we go. Consultant's paradise.
Oh, that's the best client ever. Yeah. All right. All right. Well, with that, Adam, I think, I'm just looking at my recording clock here and going, wow, that was quick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it went fast. It's good. Well, any good topics, that's what happens, right?
That's right. All right. Well, thanks, Adam. And thanks for suggesting this idea of the three-part series. I think that breaks it up nicely and gives a nice overview to the whole thing. So appreciate that.
Yeah, no problem.
All right. So with that, I think we'll shut it down for this, and then stay tuned for more episodes and more info on a assessment course. I think that'll be fun.
Yeah, I'm very much looking forward to it.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.